Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston C.A.
Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide, in the strife of truth with falsehood, for the good or evil side. The opening lines of the poem, The Present Crisis, by James Russell Lowell, suggest the crusading spirit that would animate the NAACP in launching its historically powerful magazine, The Crisis, in the first decade of the 20th century. These words also capture the zeal with which W.E.B. Du Bois would lead that magazine. He saw it as a powerful vehicle for giving African Americans a vision of a shared past and confident future. That vision would bond tragedy with achievement and suffering with pride. His efforts would help situate Black Americans within their own history and provide useful guidance on America's role in the world. My guest is Amy Helene Kirschke, author of Art in Crisis, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Struggle for African American Identity and Memory. Amy, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
Let me hold up this volume for all to see and hopefully to get for themselves and read at some point in the near future. And Amy, to start our conversation, let me say that if there's any doubt about the use of the word crisis here, I think it's very quickly dispelled in the first pages of this book. And I actually want to start this first question by reference to an incident you bring up in those first pages. There's a reunion of Civil War veterans mm-hmm. in the year 1913.
Right.
In Gettysburg, appropriately. No Black veterans are invited to attend. I thought that incident was extraordinarily powerful as well as true in depicting the kind of atmosphere that was surrounding Black Americans at the turn of the last century. And it suggests also that white America might have been more interested in a reconciliation, North and South, than with bringing Black Americans into the narrative of history. Is that correct?
Yes, I think one of the best articles I've ever written about that reunion, I've ever read about that reunion, was written by David Blight. Mm-hmm. And I put David Blight in my acknowledgments because his work on memory and identity is so fantastic. Mm-hmm. And he wrote an article that talked about how whites wanted to remember things very differently than should have been remembered. And as you said, there was a lack of Black representation. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Du Bois brought up all the time, the idea that you can't have a collective memory, you can't have a collective history, if the history is only written by one side,
exactly.
Which is the white side.
Mm-hmm. That's a perfect answer, because without that collective memory, shared memory, there would be no, and I'd love to get you to explain this phrase, usable past for Black Americans. Is that right?
Right. One of the things, what led me to this book, basically, was the whole idea of who documents a past and who documents a present, mm-hmm. too. And the past was something that had really been taken away in the visual arts as well. Mm-hmm. In 1903, of course, Souls of Black Folk was written by Du Bois, and I was asked to write an article about what Du Bois knew about the visual arts in 1903 by Professor Dolan Hubbard. And I started going back into what was known about African American art in 1903, and almost nothing was known.
Yeah.
The artists that we know of were mostly discovered in the 30s and 40s. Very mm-hmm. few were known in 1903. He knew about the sculptor Edmonia Lewis. He knew about the painter Henry O. Tanner, who only did a few African American images, mm-hmm. and just a couple of landscape painters.
Yeah.
So he immediately addressed who was even visualizing the past of African Americans.
Yeah.
And as he famously said, African Americans had to be involved in the writing of their past and also in the imaging of their past.
This brings us to, I think, one of the most important points to talk about right at the beginning of the conversation. He saw the importance of the visual image, obviously, and that's really the power of this book. He was a man of words.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that strikes me as a kind of conversion within himself to recognize the power of the picture and of the image. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think he wasn't a man of the visual arts, and he didn't take a profound interest in it for some time.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that made him interested in the visual arts was his job at Crisis. The first issue came out in November of 1910, and the first cover was a little child with a hula hoop, basically, a toy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was either done, probably, David Levering Lewis said, I'm guessing Yolanda or Du Bois himself did it, his daughter Yolanda.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't even know what they were going to do with the covers. But right. almost immediately, the very next month, he included an image of lynching that he had borrowed from a French newspaper. Mm-hmm. So right away, he started to realize that he could really elucidate the most important issues of the day by including images. Sometimes he would use an image alone, mm-hmm. and sometimes he would use an image with an actual text.
Let's give that some emphasis. I mean, this use of the image, because for the several decades that he ran this magazine, that was one of its most powerful strengths, the image. It's the immediacy and the power to elucidate an issue. Is it also an educational tool? I mean, does he want it to have a sort of a transformational experience, if you will?
I think absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it was a unifying tool. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, it's funny, over the years that I worked on this book, I started to think that sometimes he was using images because the written word was so terrible mm-hmm. that the visual image could tell a story if you couldn't bear to read it.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the 16-page supplement in 1916 for the Waco terror lynchings, and he had some images that were horrifying. Mm-hmm. And even in the year 2000, the first time I ever read that 16-page supplement, I almost couldn't get through it. It was so painful to read.
Well, you know, in point of fact, I think your book brings this out, that some of those experiences, I think there's a lynching of a man named Sam Hose
right.
in Atlanta.
That led to
his personal sense that he had to be an activist as well as an intellectual about this.
That was in 1899. Mm-hmm. He lived in Atlanta. He was teaching at Atlanta University. Mm-hmm. And he had, in a way, thought of himself as separate. Mm-hmm. And David Levering Lewis has been a profound inspiration to my scholarship. And he basically thought of himself as a little bit separate from what was going on with blacks in the South. And then he was walking down the street, and a store that he frequented had parts of Hose in a glass jar in the window.
Parts of the man's body on display.
Right, mm-hmm. which was a common thing to divide the body up, and people would sell it. In Hose's case, it was even more horrifying. Parts of his organs were even boiled and divided and sold. Mm-hmm. And he was so horrified by that. That was one of the first things that changed his idea about racial terrorism. And the second was the Atlanta race riots. Mm-hmm. And he said he was on campus, could hear the shotguns, and actually bought a gun.
Right. I think those riots involved something like 10,000 people
right.
chasing the black population.
And his daughter and wife were in Atlanta when he was in Alabama, yeah. and he came back home for it.
Now, I'm glad you bring that out, because it's the power of these horrible events that leads to the passion, that leads to the crisis doing what it did. Give us a sense, Amy, and this is a vast topic for you to cover in just a minute or two, but we're talking about scores of artists over time mm-hmm. who do this. In some sense, you can describe the works they did. For example, I know there were cartoons, there were paintings, there
right.
were a wide variety. I know there were men and women. Linda Wheeler is
right.
a woman, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Some names were famous. Romare Bearden.
Very few were famous, and none were at the time.
Okay, but right. how would you say, what kind of art appeared in this book, and what did it...
Well, he actually was a pretty strong supporter of women artists, as you mm-hmm. said. There were several women that he used regularly, including Wheeler Waring. He also had Vivian Schuyler Key. There were several people that he worked with. Mm-hmm. And the thing that was interesting about his use of art was he used some photographs, but mm-hmm. he seemed more interested in new creations and in drawings, in etchings, in some reproductions and paintings. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he would use pieces that were printed in newspapers, but primarily they were original to his magazine. And one of the most important artists who worked for him was Albert Alex Smith. And interestingly enough, Smith sent his works from Paris. He lived in Paris.
Right.
He didn't feel comfortable staying in the States.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a pretty horrible time for black Americans to be in the States, to be quite
Absolutely.
Honest about it. No one should think, and I think the book makes this clear, that this was, shall we say, schlock art. A lot of it was quite good. And in fact, I've read some references, I think, in the book itself, that you can view at least many of the works as contributions to modernist art. I mean, they really
Absolutely.
Are solid pieces of
Actually,
work.
Actually, Aaron Douglas, who's on the cover of this book, is a great example of that. This is a man who came to Harlem in 1925, mm-hmm. a college-educated African-American, took a risk to leave a very safe high school teaching job, mm-hmm. and and within the first week, Du Bois hired him, A, to do some illustrations, and B, to work eventually in the mailroom
yeah.
just to keep him alive. And he was influenced by Cubism, by Orphism, all of the really cutting-edge movements of art. And his work is really cutting-edge in the modernist milieu.
I love that expression, cutting edge, because it alludes to something else you bring out about Du Bois, the crisis, and this whole art project. That what he was really after here, if I understood it, is kind of the creation of a canon of African-American art that would be recognized as a major contribution to the art world itself. I mean, it would speak not just to history, but also to art, to
yes.
beauty, and to truth. I mean, it would be...
Absolutely.
That profound.
And he actually felt that, among other things, he was concerned about no black patronage. He understood issues of patronage, and he thought, whites are not going to pay for images of African-American life and culture. Blacks aren't yet in a position to do so. So even that was part of the mm-hmm. whole scenario. I tell my students that, when you're standing in the checkout line of a grocery store, we all grab things when we see an image. Uh-huh. But he was thinking in the same way, too. He was also a marketing guy, mm-hmm. and he knew what would sell. And in fact, when the Opportunity magazine was started at 23, suddenly he started putting very attractive women on the cover within mm-hmm. the year. So he right away responded to the needs of selling.
Let's talk about him for a minute, because you alluded to this earlier in something you said, and I think we could give it some emphasis. In many ways, he's a very complex man, and there's some contradictions here. For example, he's doing this sincerely and powerfully to elevate the masses, so to involve the masses. But he's been accused by historians and perhaps contemporaries of being something of an elitist.
Is this? Oh, yes. Uh-huh. He is. I mean, he believed in the talented tenth, and he talked about uh-huh. educating from the top down.
Right.
He's also complicated in his assessment of women. He called himself, in many ways, what we would call a feminist. Mm-hmm. He was very, very articulate on the pages of Crisis and with the use of women artists in his support of the suffrage movement. At the same time, he was not entirely enlightened with his treatment of women that he worked with.
Even his own family was.
Right. He was pretty awful to his family, and he had many, many extramarital affairs. Mm-hmm. He made jokes about the other Mrs. Du Bois because he had an affair with a woman named Du Bois, just by coincidence. Yeah, that David Levering Lewis wrote about his complex character, mm-hmm. and he really had a great, great confusion in some ways, yeah, I think, about yeah. what he was committed to.
Well, that brings out his humanness. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of his humanness is the fact that there are many parts to his agenda, if you will. We're talking here about the anti-lynching. We'll certainly focus on that. Mm-hmm. But employment issues, education issues, these were a big part of what he was after.
And, right. And in fact, this book is about all of the images, and it was hard to figure out how I was going to put it together. And mm-hmm. finally, I decided to do it thematically. Mm-hmm. And so his two greatest passions were turning to Africa as a source of identity right. and memory, ending lynching and using visual imagery in that process. Mm-hmm. As you said, he was interested in education. He was interested in the women's movement. Mm-hmm. He was interested in families and children and mm-hmm. progressive discussions about Planned Parenthood.
Right.
He was interested in travel. Mm-hmm. And there were some very interesting discussions of where was a safe place for a black family to go. And I love the travel essays and travel imagery as well.
And
war?
War? Well, very precisely war. I was just about to add that he took a position on World War I,
right.
closed ranks position. That is, we're going to be part of this. And, of course, many blacks said, why be part of it when they're not treating us very well here?
Right, and that didn't go too well, as mm-hmm. you know. He thought that if he could fight for perhaps better rights for black soldiers, he was willing to take a commission. He believed he would have a commission as a captain, but he basically said that he would support the involvement of African Americans with the assumption that when they came back, they would be greeted warmly and recognized for their valor. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was not the case. You think about the 369th Regiment returning. They had received the Croix de Guerre. Mm-hmm. They were pretty much considered one of the most brave regiments by the French, and they were completely ignored
right.
when they returned. So he used war imagery during the war and immediately after mm-hmm. to show the bravery, the valor, the strength of black soldiers.
Right. But of course, by the time World War II came about, he was pretty disillusioned, I thought, about this
Absolutely.
Business of being closed ranks and stuff.
And he was already gone. He had resigned in 1934. So,
exactly.
But he was already looking at, you're absolutely right, in the coming of World War II, mm-hmm. and also used World War II imagery to compare the idea, as Romare Bearden did, one of his favorite artists. Romare Bearden showed the horror of Americans at the atrocities committed against Europeans while they stood on the grounds of lynching all around them with no interest in lynching issues.
I want to talk about that specifically right now, because lynching, quite frankly, is the most powerful chapter in this book. The depictions are extraordinary. The way you describe the art that the Crisis would publish in response to these incidents and what it meant. Talk a bit about that, Amy. For example, it seems to me that they used every powerful technique they could, allegory, mm-hmm. Christian imagery, everything. I mean, how would you describe the art that specifically was addressed to lynching in this book?
Well, I think it's great that you brought up the Christian imagery, because that's one of the most profound influences. Clearly, mm-hmm. these artists were fairly familiar with Christian iconography. And I think about, for example, Lorenzo Harris, who did a Christmas in Georgia in 1916, and it showed a mob you know, big, brutally, awful men with their pulled up sleeves pulling up a young man to lynch him. And one man's back is to the viewer, to pull the viewer in, just as Christian imagery had done since 1300 in Giotto. And then there's Christ holding the lynching victim behind him, like a crucified Christ, mm-hmm. identifying with the victim. And then it says next to Christ, "Whatsoever you do to the least of your brothers, that you do unto me." There are many, many references, mm-hmm. images of Christ with a crown of thorns looking down at the lynched body, an actual photograph. Mm-hmm. Sometimes photographs were actually combined with mm-hmm. drawings, in other words. So mm-hmm. the artists were, they're largely unknown even today, but they were quite familiar with the history of art. They couldn't have used that imagery and those references without knowing about it.
Indeed. You also mentioned the Pietà. I mean, the mother, as we see in the
Absolutely.
Vatican, for example, holding the Jesus figure, a lynched victim, her son, presumably, in her arms.
And that's one of the images that you see appear. There's a woman, and it says the Negro mother on her garment, and she's looking at her child who's been crucified. And it was accompanying a lynching mm-hmm. article, and it was trying to show the sorrow of the mother. Mm-hmm. And just as the Pietà holds the dead Christ, the Virgin Mary holds the dead Christ, that imagery too, frequently there were references to the sorrow of the mother having her child falsely accused, and then having to live with the fact that her child was murdered by a mob.
Let's talk about that mob. And I want to make reference to one specific photograph in this book. It also appears in the magazine. Of course, it's on page 95 to be exact. It's a lynching in Marion, Indiana, 1930.
Right.
Tell us briefly what we see in that picture.
Well, you see two young men that have been killed. They're hanging from the tree. And a German photographer, a man named Lorenz Beiter, was there when the lynching occurred, and he shot this photograph. But what it shows us, and in fact a third victim right before the lynching occurred was set free. Somebody in the crowd proved that he hadn't been involved, and of course both victims were innocent. But and that man just died a couple months ago. But the photograph shows the sport of lynching, mm-hmm. and it shows that, as Du Bois often talked about, he said that at any lynching, it was a community event. Mm-hmm. It was celebrated. Children were brought to, and it was commemorated that was their first lynching. They might buy a postcard that was often created right on site at presses and sold there on site. There were pregnant women there smiling at the camera, dates holding their hands of their dates, a young man pointing up, an older man pointing up, the crowd seeing it as an entertainment event, a sporting event, with no sorrow whatsoever, and really boldly looking at the camera. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the postcards were sold at the event. And in this, by 1908, postcards were no longer, you couldn't just put them in the mail, so they put them in brown envelopes, lynching photographs, and it was just an amazing, horrible part of it,
the visual imagery. And I appreciate that, and I hope people watching appreciate that and remember what you said, because what should be, I think, emphasized here is that this was a public event in every sense. I mean,
Absolutely.
We're not talking about a narrow little bunch of hoodlums going out and doing something, but a mass audience.
Oh, well, schools were let out. So when a lynching was going to be held, schools were let out so children could attend. People left their offices. The more I looked into this, the more shocked I was by the whole process. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one thing that really got to me was Du Bois once said in a speech, not in the crisis, he said, "Everybody has a hand in the lynching," because the next day after the lynching, the doctor that shakes the hand of the sister of the lyncher who welcomes people into his office, or the preacher, and of course most of these people were Christians, quote unquote, and they all had a hand in it.
Yeah.
And it was a very much a communal affair.
Right. Amy, I'm sure there is art specifically in response to that. There was something I think you...
Yes, there's one amazing piece that was done in response to that lynching, and it was done by Lorenzo Harris, and it was done, published the month after the crisis put that particular image in, mm-hmm. and that was called Civilization in America, and it shows, it's a painting that they reproduced in black and white, and it shows a young man that's just been lynched. He's dead. There's a young girl holding a bowl underneath his feet while the mother cuts his toes off as souvenirs, and she holds the bowl, and she's just a pretty little girl with blonde hair. There's an old man who looks like anybody's nice grandpa with little round glasses, bringing in gasoline to catch the body on fire. Somebody stabbing him with a pitchfork. There's a man with a hatchet, so parts of his body will be removed. Helping somebody attack the victim is a young man with a big university sweater, and he looks like a football player. And that's the reality of our country's treatment of African Americans. But then, and there's several other components to that. Then there's water in between, and it shows New York City in the background, the dream, the American dream, with the Statue of Liberty, a Gothic cathedral, a blimp going overhead, a dirigible that shows progress, factories, all of the things that the promise of a future, a barge going by with the goods sold. So it's the promise, the hope, and the reality.
Right.
And really, his whole life, he very often, as you talked about in your introduction, Du Bois talked about a common hope and a common sorrow. That's actually what I wanted to name the book, but the editors wouldn't let me do it.
Well, that's quite a lovely phrase,
and
He talked about... By that common, that means for all Americans to share, to understand, to know what happened.
And he's talking in particular about African Americans. He talked about a common hope and a common sorrow in 1903 in his Souls of Black Folk, and he would use variations of that phrase afterwards. And basically, he thought that images of hope and discussions of hope and discussions of sorrow could be unifying, and that he could he wanted desperately to end lynching. He wanted the Dyer anti-lynching bill to be passed. But he also thought that if people understood that racial terrorism was occurring, even if you're safe in a big northern city or you're in California, it's happening. These are your people, that they would be interested in really fighting back politically.
By the time this part of the story ends, 1934, what do you think his sense was, or what is your sense of what progress had been achieved and what the role of the crisis might have been in getting at least that far?
I think he was terribly discouraged when he left. He was really almost forced to resign. He resigned on May 31st, 1934, and he was involved with the June and July issues. And he had felt that there was so little progress in integration and really accepting African Americans as equal, that he started to talk along the terms of segregation.
Well, this is interesting, because isn't this a phase where some people accused him of compromising?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, he gave a talk in 1934, and a young lady who was a teenager said, "You're just compromising." And he said, "You know, I'm always open to compromise." But he also felt that how can the board of directors of the NAACP turn their back? Are they saying black newspapers aren't good? Are they saying the black church isn't good, the greatest supporter of the NAACP? He just started to feel that separation was really almost required. And I want to say that one of the great effects that the crisis had was it opened the door to other important imagery. There were two shows on lynching after the crisis.
In 1935 in New York City.
Right, two. And one was the NAACP, and one was more affiliated with the Communist Party. And they had African-American and white artists very graphically addressing issues of lynching in a way that nobody had ever seen before. And that never would have happened without his incredible work in putting this imagery out there.
Well, let's take that. If there is anything further, that did, what was the penetration? Because I know there were leftist allies that the movement got in the 1930s that helped bring pressure on the lynching issue. Was there any sense of a wider penetration in the community, in the nation as a whole?
I think if I could say where I feel that the most effect came was just meeting people. When I've talked about this book, I've met people who said, you know, maybe there was 115,000 sold one year, for example, and I've met elderly people that have told me that they remember being young and seeing a copy of The Crisis in a beauty parlor or a barbershop that was so battered by the end of the month. Hundreds of people saw it. And in many ways, I feel that that was his greatest contribution, even more than the universities and libraries.
Right.
People that subscribed to it in establishments where so many people got their hands on it.
But that proves that he was right about the power of the image.
Absolutely. And I'd like to also say that he was so powerful that there were certain places, for example, in Mississippi, that you weren't allowed to mail The Crisis. And so they started sending it in brown envelopes because it would get thrown away.
What happens to the art and the magazine after his tenure?
Well, there are, for a variety of reasons, the art is not as strong as when he was there. I think with the Depression and the coming of World War II, the finances wouldn't allow for so many visual artists.
Right.
And so there are more photographs are used, which aren't as interesting, you know, maybe of a statesman or something, and also sometimes just text on the cover. So the really interesting years are when he was the editor. After he left, it just was not the same thing. But he brought people into the forefront.
His role, his commitment, his work continued all his life, did it not?
Mm-hmm.
And then the final chapters were written in Africa, is that correct?
Right, he died in Ghana. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm going to Ghana this summer, and I've never seen where he was buried, and I look forward to seeing mm-hmm. that. It's my own personal pilgrimage. But mm-hmm. He died in Ghana, and he was, you know, in many ways disillusioned. But I think one of the things I loved about working on this was I'm an art historian, and I loved working with the artists and seeing the imagery and seeing where it came from. Mm-hmm. I loved seeing how artists use images of Africa to mean of Egypt to mean Africa, which is very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But his written word with these images, that's what really moved me. He was such mm-hmm. a fantastic writer, and yet he could see the visual arts as a very strong way mm-hmm. of getting a message across.
It's interesting. Here we have a man who effectively changed himself and then helped change the way his people saw themselves.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And he was careful about what he used on the covers. And sometimes they were a little bit alluring. And a couple times the board of directors actually said they were unimpressed with. Mm-hmm. He put a African woman on who was partially, you could just see a little bit of her breast. And he was admonished for that. He was admonished another time for something that was considered a little bit risque. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think at that point he was just trying to sell some magazines.
Well, you know, I'm glad you bring that point up, because I actually could have talked about that right from the start, because he had to actually go against a lot of the NAACP's more conservative leadership to do anything of the things we've been talking about.
They weren't entirely thrilled mm-hmm. with him. He was always butting heads with them. And you know what's so interesting is when he, in the later years of Crisis, when he was producing the Crisis on, you know, downtown on Fifth Avenue,
right.
Way, way uptown in Spanish Harlem, that's where Norman Rockwell was living.
Wow.
And on the same street, you know, the NAACP Crisis offices would put out a lynching flag when a new person was lynched. And uptown, he was making very, very happy views of America.
Wow. That speaks volumes right there, Amy. And this book also speaks volumes. And I want people to read this book as I did and learn as I did from it. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, George.
It was wonderful.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Amy Helene Kirschke. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Shirana Harris. And our assistant producer is Keila Jackson. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars.